This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Helen Suzman has spent her life working within the South African political system to change her country's racist policies. She was a member of parliament for 36 years, from 1953 to 1989. For 13 of those years, she was the only member that opposed apartheid. Now that apartheid is being dismantled, she's written a book about her life fighting the system called In No Uncertain Terms. Earlier today, she told me she was hopeful that South Africa can achieve democracy. The first multiracial elections will be held in April. I asked her what South Africans will be voting on.
Well, there will be a new constitution, interim one actually, which will be put before them, which will contain also a Bill of Rights, which we've never had before. And the whole electoral system, of course, is being changed now because there's adult universal franchise for every adult citizen, irrespective of race, which is a first as well in South Africa. And they will be voting for a new government based on those concepts.
What do you think the racial makeup of the new government is likely to be?
Oh, I think without a doubt it'll be dominated by the African National Congress, which, as you know, is the major black organization with a number of white members, but it's mainly black. And since the voting public will be something like 21 to 22 million people, of whom 16 million, 14 to 16 million, none of these statistics are quite accurate, will be black. I think it inevitably is going to be an ANC-dominated government. But since it's proportional representation, it does mean that other parties, smaller parties, and the government, which is estimated to have about 20% of the vote, will also have representation in that parliament. And indeed, if they get enough pro rata votes on the proportional representation election, then they will even have a seat in the cabinet.
Do you have any reservations about a government that is likely to be run by people who have never been in government before?
No, because that would mean we'd have to go back to the old system where people are disfranchised simply because of their race or colour. And I've been fighting that all my life. So obviously I'm very pleased to see the reform movement take hold and in fact begin to look as if it's actually going to come about.
Do you know a lot of white people who supported apartheid and are now talking about leaving the country?
Well, they talk, but whether they go or not is another matter. I've heard a lot of talk, but quite honestly, I've never met anybody who's actually in the process of leaving. It's not so easy to go anymore. First of all, other countries have got recessions, economic recessions, and unless one has the special expertise which that country happens to want, it's very difficult to come into a country as an immigrant unless you have got close relatives there, a son, a mother, a father, or you happen to have, for instance, British citizenship because of your father or grandfather having been born in Britain.
As South Africa heads closer toward democracy, township violence has actually been on the rise. Is there a way that you can explain that for us?
Well, I think in a transitional period, there's always trouble. I mean, nothing is going to be an easy ride to democracy when you've had over four decades of an oppressive system dominated by a white minority, and you've had states of emergency. You've had a number of laws which have undermined the rule of law and due process, allowing people to be detained without trial and so on. So, I mean, quite obviously, it's not going to be an easy transition. Also, of course, there are factions among the black people themselves that are competing for power. It's a very valuable prize that people are going for, the government of South Africa. And so there are competing elements there. There's a tribal element that comes in, an ethnic element, such as the rivalry between the Zulus and the Inkatha movement of Chief Minister Buthelezi of KwaZulu and Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. And there's a very militant left-wing section, the Pan-Africanists, who are also competing for some place anyway in the government. And, of course, apart from the National Party, which has been in government all this time, there is a far-right group of white people, reactionaries, who certainly do not want to change the status quo of white domination. So it's a pretty turbulent scene, and this has led to violence. But apart from the political violence, there's the criminal violence. And that has largely come about because of increased unemployment and poverty. to a large measure caused by sanctions and South Africa's losing her export markets in the labor-intensive sectors of our economy. And those, of course, are occupied largely by black people.
You're a longtime ally of the African National Congress, and yet you've been critical recently of the ANC for instigating violence. In 1992, you even criticized Amnesty International for not citing the ANC for violence. What kind of violence are you referring to?
Well, I don't like disinformation. And the Institute of Race Relations, of which I happened to be president at that time, I no longer am. I had 2 years, and that was the term of office, published a little booklet by an expert on the subject. And it was, there were many complaints about it because she stated that both Amnesty and the Human Rights Commission in South Africa were giving information which was not accurate. I mean, they simply blamed everything on the Inkatha movement and exonerated the African National Congress, and that really was not true.
Were you uncomfortable about criticizing a longtime ally like the ANC?
No, I think it's silly not to criticize when you think that people are doing the wrong thing. I mean, I'm a friend of Nelson Mandela's, have been since 1967 when I visited him first on Robben Island, long before he was the world's most famous political prisoner. But if I think Nelson Mandela has said something I don't agree with, I tell him so. He doesn't get annoyed about it. He accepts it. We argue about it. I argued with him originally when he was in favor of nationalization. He no longer is, not because of my arguments, but because he's had many businessmen tell him there'll be no investment in the country if he pursues that line of reasoning. I don't agree when he says he thinks 14-year-olds should be given the vote, and I tell him so. And so it goes on. I don't like his link with the Communist Party, and I have told him so. I mean, one must criticize. Surely you don't just accept everything people do because you happen to have been on the same side in a big fight against injustice.
I should mention here that Nelson Mandela wrote the foreword to your new memoir.
Yes.
And my guest is Helen Sussman, and she was for years a dissident voice in the South African parliament, a voice against apartheid. She was in the parliament from 1953 to 89. And she's written a memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. You retired from Parliament in 1989. Does part of you really wish that you could be in Parliament in the new government that's elected in April?
Well, in a way, sometimes when I read things are happening that I'd like to stand up and talk about and argue about and criticize, I am quite sorry that I'm not there. On the other hand, you know, I've had 36 years of active parliamentary work. I am now, alas, 76 years of age, and there are times when people must just get out and let younger people take over.
It's interesting because you were in Parliament opposing apartheid, and now that that system is ending and hopefully a new democracy, a new democratic era is about to begin, you won't be in Parliament to participate in it.
No, but there I am on the outside keeping a beady eye on everything. I'm really rather pleased that I've lived long enough to see what I never expected to see.
Did you never expect to see it?
No, I honestly didn't. I thought, and I still think, you know, the government could have stayed in power for quite a long time and maintained the status quo. At a cost, of course, of the economy running even further down, at the cost of escalating black resistance, which had already reached very high levels, and at the cost of more violence, all that. But, you know, if you've got the army and you've got the police force on your side, you can hold the situation, as we saw with Yeltsin and Moscow not too long ago.
So why do you think that, since the government didn't absolutely have to change right now, why do you think it did?
Well, I think the new state president who took over at the end of 1989 from P.W. Botha had decided that apartheid had failed and that a new era had to begin for South Africa. I think they were all very late in making this decision, but nevertheless, it's been made, and that's very good. And it was because of the economy. I do not deny that sanctions played a part in expediting the end of the apartheid system, but at dire cost of thousands upon thousands of jobs And you know how important jobs are in every country in the world. Every candidate talks about creating jobs for his constituents, and it's no different in South Africa. And of course, that's the reason for the violence, which is upsetting a lot of people. And that's really the reason why a lot of people are talking anyway about wanting to leave.
So you think sanctions had something to do with
it? Oh, yes, I don't deny
and
that.
You opposed sanctions.
Yes.
If you had it to do over again, would you not oppose economic sanctions?
I would oppose economic sanctions because I think the cost was too high in a country that has no social welfare support system, no dole, no food stamps. And if you lose your job, unless you were in a skilled occupation where you contributed to an unemployment insurance fund, you get nothing. And that is why the crime has increased so terribly. I think the apartheid system would have broken down anyway because of black resistance and because of South Africans did not like the isolation from sport and cultural events in the world. And also, simply because the apartheid system no longer could be maintained. You cannot maintain segregation in an integrated economy. And all these were reasons why it broke down.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Helen Suzman. For 36 years, she was a member of the South African Parliament, a very strong voice against apartheid. She's written a new memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Helen Suzman. We're talking about her 36 years as a member of the South African Parliament, and that's the subject of her new memoir, In No Uncertain Terms. You had two young children when you first ran for Parliament in 1953.
Yes.
And serving in Parliament required you spending 6 months away from home so that you could be where the Parliament was. It was far away from where you lived. It must have been a very hard decision to run. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, I actually had decided not to do it. And then my husband, who was very supportive in my political career, said, but you should do it. It's the logical outcome of what you've been doing all these years, which was a lot of work in the background in politics and teaching economic history at the university. The girls were 10 and 13 when I went into Parliament. They weren't exactly infants. I had a resident physician in my husband at home, and grandparents who looked after the setup as well. But it was harder on them really than on me. I was very lucky because at least the girls were healthy most of the time. They weren't sickly children. And they were very preoccupied with school and sport and music and so on. And you know, there is an air service in South Africa, and I used to fly home every second weekend and sort of try to fix any domestic crises that had arisen.
You were elected to Parliament just 5 years after apartheid was codified by the National Party, just 3 years after the Racial Classification Act. So this repressive system had just been put into place in an official way. What did you see as your role as the lone voice of dissent?
Well, I only became the lone voice of dissent some years after I entered Parliament because I started as a member of the official opposition, which was the United Party, General Smuts's party, though he himself was dead by then. And we left the party there were 11 of us backbenchers who didn't like the equivocal way in which the United Party was fighting apartheid. And we left and formed our own party in 1959. And then there was a snap election in 61 after Dr. Verwoerd had taken South Africa out of the Commonwealth and declared an independent republic. And all my colleagues lost their seats at the 61 election with the exception of myself. And that sad story repeated itself in two subsequent elections in 1966 and 1970. And then in 1974, we got back six of our original members.
So for 13 years, you were the only
Yes.
voice of dissent. Did everybody in Parliament feel like your enemy? I mean, were they unfriendly to you as well as your political opposition?
Some people were quite friendly. They sort of liked me despite my views, but most of them really were very unfriendly. I mean, I never had a meal with any of my colleagues during those years. I used to go upstairs and have a meal upstairs with my secretary and researcher, or I used to have guests in the public dining room at Parliament, but I never sat down with the caucus people of the National Party or the United Party.
Were you ridiculed within Parliament for being anti-apartheid or for being female or for being Jewish?
Well, a bit of all of that, but ridiculed is not quite the word. I was attacked And that's rather different. It was much more aggressive than ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, let's say being a woman didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I reckoned, you know, I knew that if you wanted to be considered the equal of male colleagues, you had to be better than them. And let me tell you, that wasn't that difficult. And as far as being Jewish is concerned, well, you know, that depended on the way Israel behaved at United Nations, funnily enough. You know, if United Nations voted against South Africa at UN, then at least if Israel voted against South Africa resolution at UN, then I used to come in for a lot of anti-Semitic interjections. And if, on the other hand, after Israel won the Six-Day War, I was treated as a heroine, almost as if I'd done it myself, because the government identified with Israel as a sort of small country surrounded by dark-skinned neighbors, and there was this amazing Six-Day victory.
How did you keep getting reelected to parliament, having a minority point of view amongst the voting white population?
Well, the sort of constituency that I represented for 36 years was what you would call a silk stocking district. In other words, professional people, educated people, upper middle class people. They never were in competition for jobs with blacks. We could never win a seat in a blue collar area or even in the rural areas, which are very reactionary in South Africa. But, well, I started out with just a very small majority against the United Party then, not against the Nationalists. We were accused of splitting the opposition because we'd left the United Party, and that's why all my colleagues lost their seats.
You left them because they weren't vocal enough in their opposition to apartheid?
Well, they were very equivocal. They said that the policy was for economic integration but against social and political integration. And we were for integration, so that there was this constant row going on in the caucus with the small body of liberally minded people arguing with the majority in the caucus that we had to oppose laws which in fact were introducing social segregation and political segregation. So we had many rows, and in the end we walked out. Well, I was re-elected because, let me tell you, I was a good MP. I really was. I mean, I worked hard. I was very conscientious. I reported back to my constituents every year. I believe in accountability between constituents and Member of Parliament. I had my name in the phone books. I was available if anybody wanted either help or to complain about something I had done. And I made a lot of good speeches, which were really well reported in the English medium press. I got great coverage. Without them, I certainly could not have survived.
You know, I'm thinking about all the incredible repression that you were trying to fight, the murders of activists, the totally inhumane imprisonment of blacks, and especially of blacks who were leaders of the opposition. And yet, you had to voice your opposition in this very kind of genteel setting, the parliament. And granted, I know people were, you know, very vocal in arguing with each other, but still, it's kept with argument. I mean, this is the kind of thing people fight to the death over. You know what I mean? This is the kind of thing that people put their lives on the line for. And I'm wondering if it was ever frustrating to be dealing with such incredible repression and oppression, to be dealing with the people responsible for it, and to only be able to argue with them.
Well, I mean, short of taking a gun and shooting them, what else could one do? I mean, it was an opportunity at least to voice one's utter despair and dismay at what the government was doing, and knowing that this would probably be printed in the press the next day, and keep some values alive in that country. Otherwise, the whole thing was just a morass of, as you say, oppressive legislation and people being ill-treated without anybody even knowing about it. So it had its value. It's strangely enough, the government, for all its authoritarianism, had a very healthy respect for the parliamentary system, which was why I, who was known to be opposed to everything, was given very adequate time to debate.
Mm-hmm. Your children, when they grew up, left the country. Did you expect that to happen?
I wasn't surprised. First of all, I mean, they lived in an atmosphere of hearing me constantly railing about how awful things were. So that didn't encourage them to think the future would be better. But also, they both, in fact, had professions which would, I think, require international experience. My one daughter is an art historian, and obviously the great galleries are not in South Africa. And the other daughter is a specialist in nephrology, kidney diseases, and she could certainly have practiced at home, but she decided that she would come to America, and she's practicing in Boston.
Do you get to see each other much?
Well, we're lucky, you know. We're unlike the Jews of the old diaspora who left Russia and Lithuania like my father did and never saw his parents again. We are able to travel and able to bring them out to see us. So that's, you know, very fortunate.
Why did your father leave, one of the pogroms of Eastern Europe and go to South Africa?
A question I often asked him.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know South Africa well, but for instance, in the United States, there are so many Jews who are descended from people who left the Eastern European pogroms, but you don't think of them as having headed to South Africa.
Well, a lot did come to South Africa. When I say a lot, nothing compared to the millions who came to the U.S., of course. But, you know, South Africa was considered a country of great promise at the turn of the century. Gold and diamonds had been discovered. The place was doing well. The Anglo-Boer War had ended, and it looked like a possibly good place for a young Jew. My father was 17, didn't have a penny to his name when he came to South Africa, couldn't speak either language, couldn't read English. Or Afrikaans for that matter. So he had a difficult time, but he was a very energetic man with a great deal of stamina, which I've inherited. And he was a very intelligent man, and he did well. And he always, when I said to him in my really despairing moments, honestly, Pa, why didn't you go to America? And he'd say, don't be ridiculous. South Africa's the best country in the world. He wasn't particularly concerned about the rights of black people.
So you must have had a lot of disagreements with him.
Many, but, we were fond of each other, and if I could make him laugh, the argument generally ended in him offering me a scotch and soda.
Well, I want to thank you so much for telling us a little bit about your life, and thank you very, very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Helen Sussman has written a new memoir called In No Uncertain Terms. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.